Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees, transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview is from the archives. And with Father's Day right around the corner, I am so excited for the next few minutes because I am speaking with a husband and wife who are two tremendously gifted writers who write so intriguingly and thought-provokingly about parenthood, fatherhood, motherhood. Because it's Father's Day right around the corner, I'll say first that one of my guests is Michael Chabon, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and the author of a number of highly regarded novels, and most recently, a book of nonfiction, a memoir called Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. His wife is Ayelet Waldman, and also a very, very gifted writer, at least 7 novels to her credit, and much of her work springs from some of her experience as a federal public defender, and she is also well known for an essay that she wrote some years ago on motherhood. And her book is called Bad Mother, A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace. Both of these books are available now in paperback. I highly recommend both of them. And I am thrilled beyond words to be speaking with both of these fine writers today on The Morning Show. Ayelet Waldman, Michael Chabon, we welcome both of you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's terrific.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be talking with you. Tell us a little bit about what your household is like, not so much personally, but professionally. How do you coexist and collaborate and help one another as two very busy, gifted writers? What kind of a partnership is this?
Well, one that involves a tremendous amount of negotiation and reinvention every 15 minutes, wouldn't you say, honey?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the situation is always very fluid, partly just because, I think it's partly because it's the nature of the work we do that projects come and go. One or the other of us might be working, you know, now on a TV pilot, now on a movie script, now on a novel or an article or whatever it might be, and the sort of professional needs in and around that particular project are different from what came before, and so things have to be readjusted for that reason. Our schedules are always kind of shifting and changing, and then, you know, there are these children around whose schedules are always in some kind of flux or another. So there's always a lot of adjustment and fine-tuning and refinement that needs to be made. It's not like we kind of set up a schedule that worked, you know, 10 years ago, and we've stuck to it ever since. Far from it.
But the way things work right now, sort of, I mean, there's the kind of practical aspect of it, which is, you know, some of the more interesting features of that are we share an office. We didn't used to. Michael used to have this fabulous man cave out in the backyard, this fortress of solitude, complete with a really comfy leather couch, which he could nap on. And I would write in cafes in the neighborhood, and I loved that, primarily because it gave me an excuse to eat all day. But then what happened was I got terrible carpal tunnel syndrome. We actually both got it at the same time,
yeah,
which is so weirdly
so
codependent.
Yeah.
How romantic.
Yes. Sharing ice packs late at night. But then I had to sit at a desk. I could no longer write on a laptop. And Michael very graciously got rid of that wonderful couch and put a desk in his office. So now we share that office. We work back to back. His half of the office is covered in comic book, you know, paraphernalia, and what's on your walls right now? All sorts of things about music in the.
Yeah, I've got a lot of vintage 1970s funk and soul related imagery up on the walls.
And on my blackboard right now, there's a ton of stuff about Budapest in 1900 and Salzburg in 1945, and all sorts of maps of World War II. And we work out there. We have somewhat different schedules. So Michael tends to work at night and I work in the day, but we're often out there together.
Hmm. So the veritable fly on the wall would be probably a little bewildered by what...
Which way to look.
Yeah, which you think. But the more interesting part about it is that we work, even though we're always working on different projects, we work really closely together so that we drop everything when the other person has a problem that needs to be worked out. We read each other's work. We hash out the story together. We're like each other's first consultant on issues of plot, on character, on we do different things for each other. Michael, when I'm finished with a novel, Michael attacks it with an incredibly aggressive red pen, which is really fabulous. Although friends of mine,
you think it's so fabulous, don't you?
Well, I know now I do because I finished a book and I won't be done with another one for 2 years. Now I'm very happy with it. Don't ask me in 2 years when I'm, looking at my manuscript and crying.
Usually she hits me over the head with the manuscript that's all covered in red pen marks. That's the first reaction.
Michael Chabon, I read someplace that, but this is from 10 years ago, you being quoted as saying that you wrote from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. every single day, well, or at least 5 days out of a week.
Other way around, 10 p.m. to 3 a.m.
Oh, 10 p.m. to 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Ah, that makes a little more sense. Mm-hmm. Is that still something like your routine?
Actually, lately, yes. Again, we've sort of gone back to a version of my most common schedule, which is a night. I prefer to work at night, so we sort of have it arranged now that that's what I've been doing, is we've gone back to working at night, and we just move things around so that I'm able to, when I stay up that late, I need to be able to sleep in a little bit, so we've moved it so that I'm staying up late and working on the weekend night so that everybody gets to sleep in and it doesn't just fall on my shoulders to get up in the morning. And deal with the morning madness around here every single school day of the week.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael Chabon and Ayelette Waldman, husband and wife, and both tremendously gifted writers. We're talking about two books recently out, both reflections of their own lives and their lives together. Ayelette Waldman's book, Bad Mother, and Michael Chabon's book, Manhood for Amateurs. Michael Chabon, I love a moment in, I believe it's your book. That's the thing. Your two books are a little bit blurred in my head. But yes, I'm just checking to make sure. Yes, I love a chapter in your book in which you shed new light on the word amateurs. Mm. And I don't think it's particularly with that in mind that you titled your book Manhood for Amateurs. Tell us first in the more sort of obvious way you've given the book this title. But then this other idea about the word amateurs that I think is so profound.
Well, thank you. I know the immediate effect of the word amateurs when you hear it. What you think of, what we tend to think of right away is to think of unprofessional, in the most negative sense of the term, with a kind of implication of only partial competency, a lack of training or qualification. So the idea is to, in the title, to kind of play most immediately on those more negative senses of the word. But the word, even in fairly common usage, encompasses a lot more than that. And when you think about, if you think about the Olympic model, the ideal of the Olympics and the amateur athlete and kind of the cult of amateurism that still sort of flickers here and there around the world, and the idea that there's something sort of that gets you back to the original sense of the word amateur, which comes from a French word that means a lover, someone who does what he or she does out of love for it, not out of desire to get paid to do it. And so, you have these, and you can be an amateur of opera, or you can be an amateur of fly fishing. And the implication there is that you are completely consumed by it. You give it every fiber of your being, but you do so purely out of passion and love for the pursuit. And you would be doing it whether or not you got paid.
Hmm.
The word still has those senses in certain contexts. And to me, that's, I guess, at least the two things that I spend a lot of my time and energy and thought devoted to in my life are my writing and my, being a father to my kids. And both of those are things that, you know, I do them because I love them. Writing is something that I've done all my life. It's something I would do even if I weren't getting paid for it. I'm very grateful and lucky that I've been able to make a living doing it. And there's this, I think my goal as a father is to try to raise children who are amateurs of something, at least, that they find at least one thing in life that they love so immoderately, so all-consumingly, something that is worthwhile, something that enriches their lives, but also something that they do just purely out of the love of doing it.
If you'll permit me to read what you've written so wonderfully on this, you write, "Perhaps there is no perfect word for the kind of people I have raised my children to be, a word that encompasses obsessive scholarship, passionate curiosity, curatorial tenderness, and an irrepressible desire to join in the game, to inhabit in some manner, through writing, drawing, dressing up, or endless conversational riffing and Talmudic debate, the world of the endlessly inviting, endlessly inhabitable work of popular art. The closest I have ever come for myself is amateur."
Right.
In all the original best senses of the word.
The thing about amateurs is that they like to get together. You know, amateurs, to being a true amateur is something that you do with other people. And so, you know, the nucleus, I hope, for our kids is our family and each other. And they are each other's, they form a fan club together, you know, and they do have a lot of shared passions and shared enthusiasms. And to me,
well, I often say that the reason people always ask why you have so many kids. I don't know if they ask you, honey, but they always ask.
Always
wow. And lately I've been saying I have so many children because my husband was the president of a club of one his whole life, and he wanted more members. Now we have
I needed at least needed a treasurer, a vice president, and a secretary, and a sergeant at arms. So I've got
and
all
he's
that.
Got him.
Michael Chabon, I was going to go back to your wife, but because of what just was mentioned, I have to stick with you, and have you share at least a condensed version of the amazing story with which your book, Manhood for Amateurs, opens. This spoke so deeply to me, and I suspect many, many people, when they're done reading your wonderful book, will remember nothing so potently as the very first story in the book, which is an odd echo of what you and your wife were just talking about.
Well, yes. I mean, when I was about 10 years old, I got this brilliant idea that I was going to start a comic book club in the town that I grew up in Columbia, Maryland. And, you know, it was purely and entirely out of this impulse that I was talking about, is that a desire to have friends, to have people to share my passion, my love of comic books with. I didn't really know anybody that was as into them as I was, and I wanted to meet some people, and I decided I would place an ad in the paper, and my mom helped me rent a room in a big community hall, and I had tables and chairs and a sign, and I very painstakingly typed up a newsletter for the first meeting of the club, and where I announced all the doings of the club and all the projects we were going to have, and you know, I was lost in my own vision of this great community that I was going to bring into being through this club, and went to the day appointed day came, and there I sat at my table with my newsletters in front of me in this big empty hall, and nobody came. And finally, right, you know, at some point, a mom and another boy showed up. A mom showed up with her son, and she could see what a pathetic situation it was, but she kind of tried to push her son into the room, you know, trying to recoup something, I guess, from the lost venture, and he had wanted nothing to do with it. He ran out as fast as he could, and that was it. And my mom came back to retrieve me, and we packed up, you know, the stuff and put the tables and chairs away, and that was the one and only meeting of the Columbia Comic Book Club.
I want to ask you about something you write towards the end of that chapter. You say, "In spite of whatever consolation my mother may have offered, that was the moment when I began to think of myself as a failure. It's a habit I never lost."
Absolutely.
Anyone who has ever received a bad review knows how it outlasts by decades the memory of a favorable word. In my heart to this day, I am always sitting at a big table in a room full of chairs behind a pile of errors, lies, and exclamation points, watching an empty doorway. My story and my stories are all, in one way or another, the same tales of solitude and the grand pursuit of connection, of success, and the inevitability of defeat. What I want to ask you about, though, is that you characterize yourself at other places in your book, and your wife, Ayelet Waldman, in her book, characterizes you as a tremendous optimist. In fact, I love, Ayelet Waldman, how you say at one point, your husband sees things as not only the glass half full, but it's a crystal goblet. So I'm trying to reconcile these two
realities. Well, here's
realities.
The thing. Only an optimist would have thought it was a good idea to convene the meeting of the Columbia Comic Book Club. You know, only an optimist would think people would show up, would entertain the kind of visions that I entertained of a room crowded with buzzing comic book fans, you know, sharing their passion and their enthusiasm. And in fact, It could have worked. I mean, some people do successfully start comic book clubs, and people show up and they blossom. It might have worked. It didn't work in my case, and I think maybe the thing about being an optimist is just as with a pessimist, if both being an optimist and a pessimist means that you're impervious to contrary evidence. So if you're a true optimist, no matter how badly things go, you always kind of retain that stubborn, I mean, to me, it's just an animal impulse. It has no conscious element whatsoever. It's just a reaction, and it's the same with pessimism. You know, things can go extremely well for a pessimist, and a true pessimist, and I should know because I'm married to one, can always find, you know, the cloud for any silver lining.
I remember there was when Bad Mother went on the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, right.
Michael, there was, after, you know, we got the news, and I don't know how long later, what, 15 minutes, Michael said, I wonder how long the glow was going to last when you could, you know, snatch defeat from the jaws of victory in that particular piece of news.
Yeah, I can't remember what was the bad thing you found in that, but you did manage to find some downside to being on the bestseller list. Okay, I know, because it was like your rank. It was like you weren't number 14, you were number 15.
This nicely segues into one of my favorite moments in Bad Mother by Ayelet Waldman, where you write this about yourself. I am cynical and pessimistic, and I don't believe in love at first sight. I believe you have to know someone to love him, have to see his good and bad side, his flaws and foibles. I believe that love grows and that attraction or infatuation cannot be the basis of a real life together. And yet, there is a word in Yiddish, bashert, that translates more or less as soulmate, intended, the one that God or fate meant for you. Tell us about how that characterizes your connection with your husband and the connection the two of you share.
Well, you know, I really don't believe in love at first sight. And yet, I mean, when Michael and I were fixed up on a blind date by his best friend from high school and my roommate in, I was living in New York after law school at the time. And I had this amazing experience when we, on our first date. First of all, he was 20 minutes late, which set the stage. I was already kvetching.
Yeah.
But, and I had worked so hard to sort of pick the perfect out. We'd had a very fun phone conversation, so I got myself obsessed about picking the perfect outfit. And then he buzzed the buzzer, and I was living at the time in a part of New York that, before Giuliani's tenure, was a complete nightmare with, you know, crack vials on the street that you'd crunch under your boots as you walked to the subway. And after Giuliani, it became this, you know, fantasy land of, I don't know, hedge fund managers or something. Anyway, I went, at this point, we were still in crack vial mode, and I went down to, I had to go down the stairs to let him in because the buzzer was broken on the building. And there, standing behind the bulletproof glass in the lobby with this adorable man holding a bouquet of irises. And I had the most amazing thought, which was not, oh, he's so perfect, or oh, this is so magical. But I thought to myself, okay, now I can finally stop dating. And I really, at that very moment, I knew that this is the person that I was going to spend the rest of my life with, even though I don't believe in that. But there it was. And it was a magical first date, and our first kiss was on the Bowery in New York City, and it's been pretty much, you know, it's been fabulous ever since. Not that it hasn't been hard, and not that it hasn't taken an incredible amount of work also, but at the core of our relationship, I think, is that remains that sense of magic and intention and some broader sense that we were meant to be together, even though I will say again and again that neither of us believe in it. We don't believe in it intellectually, but I guess we believe in it with our hearts.
I mean, I think you transfer that idea of, I mean, I don't think that would work. I don't think you actually can sustain that notion of love at first sight, or that this was meant to be, was intended. If you don't have that sort of belief in some great intender who's making matches and arranging marriages and so on, I think what you do have to do is find a way to transfer that intention to yourself. You know, mm-hmm. that the intention, that there is an intent in maintaining and sustaining and feeding this partnership that has to ultimately come from the partners themselves. That it has to, there has to be a certain constant level of intentions going on at all times, that you bear in mind that this is a that this was meant to be, and the people that are the ones doing the meaning are us.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I guess it's also, you know, if there's anything I think we both share this sense of our marriage as a personality, a body of its own, you know, that we're both committed to. You know, there's each of us as individuals, and then there's also this marriage, which is incredibly important.
Right. I mean, it's like maybe in some ways it's analogous to the Constitution, you know,
right.
in the U.S. government. It's like it's both there's a document, there's actually a piece of paper, and then there's this whole kind of ideal and these principles that are sort of enshrined in the document, and
uh-huh.
and that is ultimately what everything rests on. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I think, and then in many ways, we do that idea of having been meant to be, of being each other's, but shared, is sort of like the constitution of our marriage, and that we, you know, when things do go awry or there's a sense of being adrift in some way, just as with this country, you know, that's ultimately, you have to kind of go back to that and say, well, what are we, why did we constitute this in the first place, and what were the principles, and that always worked.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Michael Chabon, author of Manhood for Amateurs, and Ayelet Waldman, author of Bad Mother. And about halfway through our conversation, it's time for us to talk about parenthood. And in particular, the distinct expectations that society at large seems to have when it comes to fathers and mothers. And as we read your two books, and as you each write about your own experiences as parents, that's maybe the single most striking divide between what the world seems to expect. Michael Chabon, you write at the top of one of your first chapters, "The handy thing about being a father is that the historic standard is so pitifully low." And on the other hand, Ayelet Waldman, much of the first chapter of your book is about the absurdly high standards which society seems to have from mothers.
Absolutely.
You say this book is about the perils and joys of trying to be a decent mother in a world intent on making you feel like a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to start in our efforts to make sense
of that?
Michael,
tell the story about standing in line with the baby viewing.
Well, I tell the story in the piece that you just referred to, that moment of insight arises out of this experience that is has happened to me in many different versions and many different contexts since I became a dad. But you know, I was in our neighborhood supermarket one day, our little corner market rather, just standing there in line waiting to pay for my stuff, and I was holding our youngest son in my arms, and I was, you know, literally not doing anything. I was holding him, I was thinking random thoughts, I was getting ready to pay for my groceries. And I became aware of this woman standing behind us who was just beaming at us so fondly, almost insanely fondly, smiling and looking at us. And you know, finally she just couldn't contain herself anymore, and she said, "You are a great dad. I can just tell." And, you know, like I said, I've had this experience before, and as with every other time, I just thanked her and, you know, took it as the compliment that she meant it, but actually, inside it really rankled me, because I wasn't doing anything.
And he does. The thing is, you are a great dad.
Right. I work very hard at it. I do so much that this woman has never seen, you know, that involves discomfort, trouble, heartache, problem solving, just simply kind of physically showing up and keeping track of stuff and all of these things that I do that because it is important to me to be a good father. And then to get, I mean, there's almost nothing more infuriating than being praised for something that, you know, that you yourself regard as not worthy of praise.
You know what's more infuriating? Never being praised for things that are worthy of praise.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, I'm fully aware of that. And you know, that was part of my thought at that moment, too, is like, what would it take? What would a woman have to do? What would a mother have to do in this situation for some total stranger to come up to her and say, you are a really great mom, I can tell. And, you know, as I said in the piece, she would have to engage in some kind of super heroic, you know, saving her child's life from choking while at the same time purchasing healthy snacks and, you know, also mentally coming up with a new plan for organizing her kids' closets all at once. And even in that case, everybody would just probably look at her and think, well, duh, you're the mom.
I like how you say at one point, Michael, I know there is a double standard at work. I suppose if I'm honest, I would have to acknowledge that in my worst moments, I'm grateful for it.
Sure.
For the easy credit that people, mothers, for God's sake, are willing to extend to me for doing very little at all. And on the other hand, you talked about how it is in part the monumental open-endedness of the job, that is now talking about motherhood, with its infinite number of infinitely small pieces that routinely leads mothers to see themselves as inadequate, therefore making the task of recognizing their goodness at any given moment so hard. Eilert Wildman, what's it like to be a mother, bearing those kind of expectations from yourself and the world?
Well, you know, it's so funny. When I was writing the book, I asked a bunch of my friends what was a good mother. I just wanted, you know, I said, give me your definition of a good mother. And their definition, the one that these moms themselves gave, it was hilarious. It was like some you know, combination of Mary Poppins and June Cleaver and Martha Stewart and Dr. Spock all rolled. Oh, and also, you know, she has to be physically fit and gorgeous and all rolled into one, embodying some perfect placid sense of, you know, constant goodwill and devotion to her child above all else. And, you know, the ribbon that ran through everybody's definition is something other than me. A good mother is something that I could never possibly aspire to be. And it was all said, you know, it was all said in the best of humor. But I think that's actually what most of us feel at the, you know, all the time, is that, you know, if we work, we feel like we're harming our kids by not being there. If we don't work, we feel like we're harming our kids by not providing a role model of someone who, you know, works out in the world. I mean, there's just this endless sense of failing to measure up. And if my book does anything, it's kind of a, you know, begs us to reevaluate that sense and to try to give ourselves and each other a break every once in a while.
Right.
You, I mean, it's a nice thought. You know, I do, I feel like I try all the time to do that, and I succeed about 11% of the time.
Hmm. You, of course, wrote so memorably about motherhood and the place of your own parenthood in your life.
Uh-huh.
And attracted an incredible firestone a storm of criticism about your honest statement about what motherhood meant to you and in a sense where it fit into your own personal framework. I'm especially curious to know how much you expected that response. I mean, surely you had to know that somebody was going to take issue with what you said.
Despite the fact that I seem to say controversial things every time I open my mouth, I'm always surprised at the extent of the controversy. You know, there's an old saying, a father's, the most important thing a father can do for his child is to love the child's mother. And that's, you know, that's an old saying that people have said all the time. And essentially that's what my essay said, that the most important thing a mother can do for her children is to love their father. And I did I mean, part of the reason I didn't expect the firestorm was because I wrote the piece initially for this anthology, and, you know, nobody reads those. And the difference became when the piece ended up getting picked up for the New York Times, and I hadn't really, I was so excited about having it be in the New York Times, which is, you know, I grew up in northern New Jersey, it's my paper of record, that I didn't sort of put together the difference between having that essay in which I basically say that if a good mother is a mother who loves her husband, her children more than anyone else in the world, well, then I'm a bad mother because I love my husband more than my children. I hadn't put together the ramifications of having that read by 5 million people as opposed to 5 people.
Right.
And so it was, but even so, you know, sometimes something just kind of captures the zeitgeist. And I think especially we are in this country obsessed with stories of bad mothers. And when there is a story of a bad mother that excites our interest, we see that story everywhere. From the, you know, incredibly tragic cases of a mother like Andrea Yates who drowned her children in the bathtub, to the sort of ridiculous things of like Britney Spears, you know,
driving
with her baby on her lap. I mean, those stories become obsessions for us. And what happened with that essay is it became a very momentary obsession. And, you know, we woke up, we went to sleep on Sunday, and the, you know, oh, cool, look, my essay is in the New York Times. And we woke up on Monday morning, and, it, you know, it was like we were in the middle of a tornado.
Oh, my God, I'm married to Andrea Yates.
Well, and I wonder if part of it was that your essay, when couched in the midst of 32 other essays from a number of different writers reflecting on motherhood in different ways, it probably still would have rankled a few readers, but probably not to the same extent as
yep.
when here it was, this solitary expression of thoughts that probably a lot of people have perhaps felt and yet never outwardly expressed.
Right. And it's true, you know, I keep thinking about why people got so upset. And the people who got so upset were all women, and primarily women of a certain education level and class, like basically mine. And what made people, you know, I kept wondering what, you know, you read something you disagree with in the paper, which happens to me every single day. You kind of roll your eyes, or maybe you, you know, call the writer an idiot and you move on. And there were people who just never moved on. I mean, I had a year later, I was doing an event, and it was this event, you had to buy the book and pay for lunch. It was a serious investment of time if you wanted to come to this event where I was appearing, and money too. And this woman came, and she paid her $25, and she came up to me and she said, I'm here today because I'm so obsessed with that essay you wrote that my husband said finally he just couldn't stand it anymore, and I had to go confront you. And this is a full year later, and all I could think of was, oh, honey, you know, just get over it. Call me an idiot and move on. But, you know, but I think that something happens nowadays when we write about women in their 30s and 40s, women of my sort of caught in the middle, for lack of a better word, post-feminist generation. And it's like it isn't even so much that you write an essay, but you write a Rorschach blot. And everybody reads something about their lives in that, and they read an indictment of themselves in anything that's written about women of that generation. And that's what happened. You know, what I said or didn't say was not nowhere near as relevant as what the woman who was reading it experienced and was feeling about herself and her marriage and her children.
Hmm. And of course, that's one of the most important reasons to write provocative stuff, is for the way it gets people thinking and mm-hmm. reflecting about their lives in ways they never did before. Michael Chabon, you write so perceptively about the way the world has changed since the time when you and I were growing up in a couple of very intriguing ways. For instance, you write a whole chapter just about Legos and the way Legos have changed from when they first emerged here in America. Say a word about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, when, you know, as you remember, when I was young, Legos were this, they were all about abstraction. They were very abstract play things where you and the Lego company themselves never would have presumed to tell you what to make out of your Legos. They might offer some suggestions. There would be a little brochure with some pictures of the kinds of things you might want to try to make out of your Legos, with no guidelines given for how to do that. And everything you made out of them kind of sort of looked like what it was supposed to be, but it also clearly was made out of these rectangles and squares which was essentially all we had to build with at the time, in a very limited palette of colors. That was how I remembered Legos being. I loved Legos. I put them aside. I grew up, and then I had children of my own and went to the store to buy them Legos and came home with this incredibly elaborate American Indian playset for our oldest child that had, very detailed, specific instructions of exactly how to reproduce with your Legos, which now came in all kinds of shapes and sizes and colors, the picture on the front of the box. Or the pictures that were in the brochure. And what also had changed, as I soon discovered, was that there was all kinds of corporate branding going on, marketing going on in the world of Legos, that you had Star Wars playsets and NBA playsets and all of these very clear almost requirements of what to build with your Legos, and everything has to come out looking very realistic and exactly like what it is supposed to be. And that just seemed to me to be this crucial shift in the idea of what play was and who was in charge of children's play. And I found it depressing, and I kind of rebelled against the whole idea of it. But
that was mostly
because
he spent 3 weeks of his life assembling an AT-AT.
Oh, God. Exactly. You know, and what it had become was modeling. Like, Lego had become modeling, where, and we know there always was modeling. Modeling was always is fun and always has been fun, but that's not what Lego used to be about, and I resented it. But what I then realized in the course of, a couple of years of watching my children get older and destroy the models that we had made out of the Legos and have them fall apart and break and collapse, is that then they all do go into this big welter of drawers and bins, and then the kids start to mix and match, and what I realized was we live in this time of sampling, of the mashup, where the way that young people today approach the art that they love and the art that they consume and that they make themselves is to take bits and pieces from here and there. You take the sound, the beat from one song and the chorus from another song, and you sample in pieces of this and that, and you create this new artifact that is your own, but which you've made out of bits and pieces of other things. And of course, that's always what art has been about to one degree or another. And I saw that, in fact, yes, there is this sort of controlling corporate ethos at work in the Lego sphere, but that kids, as they always do, because kids are subversive people, that they do find these ways to subvert and to kind of regain control for themselves of the materials of play that they've been given.
A last quick question. I know we're about out of time. Ayelet Waldman, I think the most memorable chapter in your book is the chapter called Rocket Ship, in which you talk about feeling compelled to end a pregnancy because of medical issues with the fetus, and of the desperate sorrow that you felt over that, you and your husband. And one of the things you write in this chapter is, yet in the wake of all of that, I found myself desperate to write. I had the sense that I wasn't ever going to understand and learn to live with what had happened unless I wrote about it. I wasn't going to return to even a facsimile of the person I'd been before without the comfort of solitude and words. Beyond that really powerful story, I imagine for both of you that is true, that one of the ways you navigate through marriage and parenthood and your own lives is through this wonderful gift you've been given of writing.
That's absolutely true. Although I should say that it wasn't that I felt compelled to terminate the pregnancy, but rather I chose to. And it was dealing
right.
with that choice that made me, that was so difficult for me. I feel like that's one of the most, I've gotten so much from my husband. I've learned so much from him. He's enriched my life in ways that I never imagined that I would have this life that he has given me. But one of the things, the most profound gift he's given me is, he's introduced me to the joys of the literary life. And I was always a reader, but I never allowed myself to imagine the possibility of being a writer. And it was only because Michael was there as a model and encouraged me that I could find that. And it is the way we both trans translate the world. It is the way we both experience the world. It's the one of the greatest ways we take pleasure in the world. And of all the things you've given me, sweetie, it's, you know, and it's saying a lot because you've given me these four incredible kids. It's one of the most beautiful and important.
Thank you. I'm all for Klimt.
Ayelette Waldman's book is Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. Michael Chabon's book is Manhood for Amateurs, the pleasures and regrets of a husband, father, and son. Both of these books now available in paperback. They belong on everyone's shelf. And I am so grateful for this pleasure and opportunity and honor to speak with both of you. Thank you so much.
It's been a real joy for us, too. Thank you so much.
8:50 the time at WGTD. This is the Thursday morning show on WGTD and part two now of today's program.
We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with Dr. Brian Klassen, who is a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and a specialist in movement disorder. And he has been involved in a very exciting kind of treatment, which has been fine-tuned in recent years to become even more effective. It is an exciting innovation called deep brain stimulation. We're going to be talking with him for the next few minutes about what is involved in deep brain stimulation and what a gigantic difference it can make in the lives of people suffering from one movement disorder or another. Dr. Klassen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Tell us first briefly, what is going on in the body with something like Parkinson's disease that causes the kind of movement disorders that we observe? What is going wrong in the body and specifically in the brain?
Well, these movement disorders actually originate in the brain, and they each have their different ways that they occur. In Parkinson's disease, for the motor symptoms, one of the main problems is that there's not as much dopamine as we need, and that feeds into motor circuits and can set off some abnormal rhythms. And when you think about DBS, deep brain stimulation, as a therapy, it's really not just Parkinson's, but multiple diseases. And the common thread there is one of abnormal rhythms in the brain causing symptoms, and then trying to correct or at least improve those abnormal rhythms so that the symptoms lessen.
So when we read about deep brain stimulation, one of the first things we see is that it involves implanting electrodes directly into the brain, which sounds like the stuff of science fiction horror films, but in fact has been a reality for some time now. Describe typically how this unfolds, typically what happens when deep brain stimulation is done. I mean, in terms of what actually sort of mechanically happens to the patient.
Yeah, so to have this therapy applied for a patient, they do have to have a surgery to get the system implanted. And what happens is, what you term an electrode, it's really a wire with just spots that we can use to send electricity, is implanted in the brain through a very small incision and hole, and a very fancy contraption that lets us implant very accurately a wire toward the middle of the brain. So it's not a major surgery with a lot of brain exposure or anything like that. It's a very simple procedure to deliver just a wire or two, if there's both sides of the brain implanted, into the brain. And then that allows us, after the fact, to put stimulation into the wire. And I think you made a great point, is it kind of sounds like science fiction, but it's really not. In fact, it's been standard of care therapy for over 20 years. The first device FDA approved for tremor, it was approved in 1997. And so while it sounds new to a lot of people, it's really been happening for quite some time.
It sounds like, however, in the last several years, that the means by which this has done maybe has been more closely perfected. There are ways in which this is now done better, done more effectively than maybe it was in the early days. In what ways has this kind of procedure been fine-tuned?
You bet. So as with any therapy, the longer that centers are doing it, the better they're going to get at it. And so I think most centers are very good now at accurately placing the electrodes exactly where they need to be. We know a little bit more what to look for as far as effects and side effects. We probably even know, you know, step before that, who's a good candidate and who's not going to be a good candidate, which maybe wasn't as well known before. So I think outcomes, even with this, the same approach we were using before, are probably better now for all of those reasons. And then there are now newer systems and newer methods coming online to even more finely direct the current. And so some of the new systems will have electrodes that instead of just putting out the electricity in a circle around the lead can steer it in one direction or the other, and that may help for certain patients. So that's one of the new things. And there's newer ways to interface with these systems because, of course, if it's an implanted system, then you have to interface with it wirelessly. And so now instead of very medical devices, some of these are being interfaced with more touchscreens that the physicians and the patients are a little more used to as well.
Mm. And once these electrodes have been implanted in a patient's brain, then how often and for what sort of period of time would this stimulation occur? And does that widely vary from patient to patient in terms of whether or not they will undergo this periodically for the rest of their lives, or if this, in certain cases, actually leads to an end to the disorder for all intents and purposes? I mean, typically, what happens once the electrodes have been implanted?
Yeah, that's a good question. So once the electrodes are implanted, that sort of allows the provider to start with the process of deep brain stimulation, because really it's all about the stimulation, not just the procedure. And so the stimulation is not actually a cure for any of these diseases. What it does is it improves symptoms. And so the patient would have programming, the settings would be tuned up, but really that system would have to stay on for the duration. If the system was turned off or taken back out, for example, then the symptomatic improvement we're seeing would be expected to go away. We're not really changing the underlying disease. We're just improving symptoms. But it can be pretty miraculous for some patients, particularly for tremor. If you have tremor and the tremor is really very minimal after the procedure, it can be life-changing, even though technically we haven't cured the tremor disorder.
Right. And is this something then that occurs every single day, all day long, or intermittently all day long, or every few days? Or does that also vary widely from patient to patient and from disorder to disorder?
There's a little bit of variance. For most disorders, it's on pretty much 24 hours a day. For tremor, some patients will turn the device off at night because you really don't need tremor control while you're sleeping, and then turn it back on in the morning. So, but it would be on during the day typically. And the only other real standard of care therapy now, where we might have a little bit of variance in how often it's on, is in epilepsy, which has been newly approved. And sometimes patients may cycle through a few minutes on, a few minutes off. But it's usually not intermittent, such as one day you have stimulation and then you wait a few days until you do it again. It's something that's always going on in the background.
Well, it's certainly gratifying to see this development and the way in which it has made life so much better for so many patients dealing with movement disorders of one kind or another. And Dr. Brian Klassen, a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, at the forefront of this exciting field, I appreciate so much you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this. Very best wishes to you and all your colleagues at the Mayo Clinic.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be sharing with you an interview I am about to record with best-selling author Jared Yates Sexton, a contributing political writer at Salon, and a writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, New Republic, and many, many other places. While covering the Trump campaign for president, it was Jared Yates Sexton who coined the term toxic masculinity. He has written a very powerful and revelatory memoir about his own life growing up in a small town in Indiana. The book is titled The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. That will be tomorrow's morning show. We remind you that The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And The Morning Show is also available as a podcast, a different morning show, 7 days a week. You can access The Morning Show podcast and look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Spotify, Google Podcasts,